Perhaps they truly did run lunatic. On the other hand, the wee bitch had undoubtedly been playing the loon with someone. With her apron up like that, the bairn was showing plainly, a hard round swell like a calabash under her thin petticoat. "How long?" he asked Christie, with a nod toward her. 6 months gone," Christie said, and sank reluctantly onto the offered stool. He was dour as Jamie had ever seen him, but in control of himself. That was something.
"It was when the sickness came last summer, when I was here, helping to nurse his wife," Mulver burst out, lowering her apron and staring reproachfully at her father, full lip a-tremble. "And not just the once, either." She switched her gaze back to Jamie, wet-eyed and pleading. "Tell them, sir, please. Tell them the truth."
"Oh, I mean to," he said, giving her a black look. "And you'll do the same, lass, I assure you."
The shock of it was beginning to fade, and while his sense of irritation remained, in fact, it was growing by the moment, he was beginning to think, and furiously. She was pregnant by someone grossly unsuitable, that much was clear.
Who? Christ, he wished Claire had stayed. She listened to the gossip on the ridge, and she took interest in the lass. She'd know which young men were likely prospects. He'd seldom noticed young Mulver particularly himself, save she was always about helping Claire.
"The first time was when herself was so ill as we despaired of her life," Mulver said, snapping him back to attention. "I told you, Feyther, it was no rape, only himself being off his heed with the sorrow of it, and me as well."
She blinked, a pearly tear sliding down the unmarked cheek.
"I came down from her room late at night to find him in here, sitting in the dark and greeting. I felt so sorry for him."
Her voice shook, and she stopped, swallowing.
"I asked, could I fetch him a wee bite, maybe something to drink? But he'd drink taken already. There was whiskey in a glass before him."
"And I said, no, thank you kindly, and that I'd be alone," Jamie broke in, feeling the blood begin to surge in his temples at her recounting. "You left."
"No, I didn't."
She shook her head. The cap had come half off when she fell, and she hadn't settled it again. Dark tendrils of hair hung down, framing her face.
"Or rather, you did say that to me, that you'd be alone. But I couldn't bear to see you in such straits. And I know 'twas forward and unseemly, but I did pity you so much," she burst out, looking up and then immediately dropping her gaze again. I came and touched him," she whispered,
so low that he had trouble hearing her.
"Put my hand on his shoulder, like, only to comfort him. But he turned then, and put his arms round me all of a sudden, and grasped me to him, and then,"
she gulped audibly,
he took me, just there."
The toe of one small buskin stretched out, pointing delicately at the rag rug just in front of the table, where there was, in fact, a small and ancient brown stain which might have been blood. It was blood. Jemmy's, left when the wee lad had tripped on the rug and bumped his nose so it bled. He opened his mouth to speak, but was so choked by outraged amazement that nothing emerged but a sort of gasp.
"So you've not the balls to deny it, eh?"
Young Alan had recovered his breath. He was swaying on his knees, hair hanging in his face and glaring.
"Balls enough to do it, though."
Jamie gave Alan a quelling look, but didn't bother replying to him. He turned his attention instead to Tom Christie.
"Is she mad?" he inquired. "Or only clever?"
Christie's face might have been carved in stone, save for the pouchy flesh quivering beneath his eyes, and the eyes themselves bloodshot and narrowed.
"She's not mad," Christie said. "A clever liar, then."
Jamie narrowed his own eyes at her.
"Clever enough to ken no one would believe a tale of rape."
Her mouth opened in horror.
"Oh, no, sir," she said, and shook her head so hard the dark curls danced by her ears. "I should never say such a thing of you. Never!" She swallowed, and timidly raised her eyes to meet his, swollen with weeping, but a soft dove grey, guileless with innocence. "You needed comfort," she said softly but clearly. "I gave it you."
He pinched the bridge of his nose hard betwixt thumb and forefinger, hoping the sensation would wake him from what was plainly nightmare. This failing to occur, he sighed and looked at Tom Christie. "'Tis with child by someone, and not by me," he said bluntly. "Who might it have been?"
"It was you,"
the girl protested, letting her apron fall as she sat bolt upright on her stool.
"There's no one else."
Christie's eyes slid reluctantly toward his daughter, then came back to meet Jamie's. They were the same dove grey, but they'd never possessed any trace of either guilelessness or innocence.
"I know of no one," he said.
He took a deep breath, squaring his stocky shoulders.
"She says it wasn't just the once.
That you had her a dozen times or more."
His voice was nearly colourless, but not from lack of feeling, rather from the grip he had upon his feelings.
"Then she's lied a dozen times or more," Jamie said, keeping his own voice under as much control as Christie's.
"You know I have not.
Your wife believes me," Malva said, and a steely note had entered her voice. She lifted a hand to her cheek, where the flaming colour had subsided, but where the print of Claire's fingers was still clear, livid in outline.
"My wife has better sense," he said coldly,
but was conscious, all the same, of a sinking sensation at the mention of Claire. Any woman might find such an accusation shock enough to make her flee, but he did wish that she'd stayed. Her presence, stoutly denying any misbehaviour by him and personally rebuking Mulver's lies, would have helped.
"Does she?"
The vivid colour had faded from the girl's face altogether, but she had stopped weeping. She was white-faced, her eyes huge and brilliant.
"Well, I've sense as well, sir. Sense enough to prove what I see."
"Oh, aye," he said sceptically. "How?"
"I've seen the scars on your naked body. I can describe them."
That declaration brought everyone up short. There was silence for a moment, broken by Alan Christie's grunt of satisfaction. He rose to his feet, one hand still pressed to his middle, but an unpleasant smile upon his face.
"So then," he said, "nae answer to that one, have ye?"
Irritation had long since given way to a monstrous anger. Under that, though, was the barest thread of something he wouldn't, not yet, call fear.
"I dinna put my scars on display," he said mildly, "but there are a number of folk who've seen them nonetheless. I havena lain with any of them either."
"Aye, folk speak sometimes of the scars on your back," Malva shot back. "And everyone kens the great ugly one up your leg that you took at Culloden. But what of the crescent-shaped one across your ribs, or the wee one on your left hurdy?"
She reached a hand behind her, cupping her own buttock in illustration.
"Not in the centre quite, a bit down on the outer side. About the size of a farthing."
She didn't smile, but something like triumph blazed in her eyes.
"I havena got,"
he began, but then stopped, appalled.
Christ, he did.
A spider's bite taken in the Indies that festered for a week, made an abscess, then burst to his great relief. Once healed, he'd never thought of it again. But it was there. Too late. They'd seen the realization cross his face. Tom Christie closed his eyes, jaw working under his beard. Alan grunted again with satisfaction and crossed his arms.
"Want to show us she's wrong?" the young man inquired sarcastically. "Take down your breeks and gie us a look at your backside, then."
With a good deal of effort, he kept himself from telling Alan Christie what he could do with his own backside. He took a long, slow breath, hoping that by the time he let it out again, some useful thought would have come to him. It didn't. Tom Christie opened his eyes with a sigh.
"So," he said flatly, "I suppose you'll not intend to put aside your wife and marry her?" "I should never do such a thing."
The suggestion filled him with fury and something like panic at the mere notion of being without Claire.
"Then we'll draw a contract."
Christie rubbed a hand over his face, shoulders slumped with exhaustion and distaste.
"Maintenance for her and the bairn. Formal acknowledgement of the child's rights as one of your heirs. You can decide, I suppose, if you wish to take it for your wife to rear, but that..." "Get out!"
He rose very slowly and leaned forward, hands on the table, eyes fixed on Christie's.
"Take your daughter and leave my house!"
Christie stopped speaking and looked at him, black-browed. The girl had started greeting again, making whimpering noises into her apron. He'd the odd feeling that time had stopped somehow. They would all just be trapped here forever, himself and Christie, staring each other down like dogs, unable to look down, but knowing that the floor of the room had vanished beneath their feet, and they hung suspended over some dreadful abyss in the endless moment before the fall. It was Alan Christie who broke it, of course. The movement of the young man's hand going to his knife freed Jamie's gaze from Christie's, and his fingers tightened, digging into the wood of the table. An instant before, he'd felt bodiless. Now blood hammered in his temples and pulsed through his limbs, and his muscles trembled with an urgent need to damage Alan Christie and wring his sister's neck to stop her noise as well. Alan Christie's face was black with anger, but he'd sense enough, barely, Jamie thought, not to draw the knife.
"I should like nothing better, wee man, than to gie you your head in your hands to play with," he said softly. "Leave now, before I do it."
Young Christie licked his lips and tensed himself, knuckle-bones going white on the hilt. But his eyes wavered. He glanced at his father, who sat like a stone, grim-jowled and square. The light had changed. It shone from the side and through the grizzled tufts of Christie's beard, so his own scar showed, a thin pink rope that curled like a snake above his jaw. Christie straightened slowly, pushing himself up with his hands on his thighs, then shook his head suddenly like a dog shaking off water. He gripped Mulva by the arm, lifted her from her stool, and pushed her before him, weeping and stumbling on the way out. Alan followed them, making occasion to brush so near Jamie as he left that Jamie could smell the younger man's stink, ripe with fury. Young Christie cast a single angry glance back over his shoulder, hands still on his knife, but left. Their tread in the hall made the floorboards tremble under Jamie's feet, and then came the heavy slam of the door. He looked down then, vaguely surprised to see the battered surface of the table and his own hands still flattened there, as if they'd grown to it. He straightened up, and his fingers curled, the stiff joints painful as they made themselves into fists. He was drenched with sweat. Lighter footsteps came down the hall then, and Mrs. Bug came in with a tray. She set it down before him, curtsied to him, and went out. The single crystal goblet that he owned was stood on it, and the decanter that held the good whisky. He felt obscurely that he wanted to laugh, but couldn't quite remember how it was done. The light touched the decanter, and the drink within glowed like a chrysoberyl. He touched the glass gently in acknowledgement of Mrs. Bug's loyalty, but that would have to wait. The devil was loose in the world, and there'd be hell to pay, surely. Before he did aught else, he must find Claire. After a time, The drifting clouds boiled up into thunderheads, and a cold breeze moved over the top of the hollow, shaking the laurels overhead with a rattling like dry bones. Very slowly, I got to my feet and began to climb. I had no sure destination in mind, didn't care really if I were wet or not. I only knew that I couldn't go back to the house. As it was, I came to the trail that led to the white spring just as rain began to fall. Huge drops splattered on the leaves of pokeweed and burdock, and the firs and pines let go their long-held breath in a fragrant sigh. The patter of drops on leaves and branches was punctuated by the muffled thud of heavier drops striking deep into soft earth. Hail was coming with the rain, and suddenly there were tiny white particles of ice bouncing crazily on the packed needles, peppering my face and neck with stinging cold. I ran then, and took shelter beneath the drooping branches of a balsam fir that overhung the spring. The hail popped the water and made it dance, but melted on impact, disappearing at once into the dark water. I sat still, arms wrapped around myself against the chill, shivering.
"You could almost understand," said the part of my mind that had begun talking somewhere on the journey up the hill. "Everyone thought you were dying, including you. You know what happens. You've seen it. People under the terrible strain of grief, those dealing with the presence of overwhelming death." I'd seen it. It was a natural seeking of solace, an attempt to hide only for a moment, to deny death's coldness, by taking comfort in the simple warmth of bodily contact. "But he didn't," I said stubbornly, out loud. "If he had, and that was it, I could forgive him. But God damn it, he didn't." My subconscious subsided in the face of this certainty, but I was aware of subterranean stirrings, not suspicions, nothing strong enough to be called doubts. Only small, cool observations that poked their heads above the surface of my own dark well like spring peepers. High, thin pipings that were barely audible individually, but that together might eventually form a racket of sound to shake the night. "You're an old woman. See how the veins stand out on your hands. The flesh has fallen away from your bones. Your breasts sag." If he were desperate, needing comfort. He might reject her, but could never turn away from a child of his blood. I closed my eyes and fought a rising sense of nausea. The hail had passed, succeeded by heavy rain, and cold steam began to rise from the ground, vapor drifting upward, disappearing like ghosts into the downpour. "No," I said aloud. "No." I felt as though I had swallowed several large rocks, jagged and dirt-covered. It wasn't just the thought that Jamie might, but that Mulva had most certainly betrayed me. Had betrayed me if it were true, and still more if it were not. My apprentice? My daughter of the heart. I was safe from the rain, but the air was thick with water. My garments grew damp and hung heavy on me, clammy on my skin. Through the rain I could see the big white stone that stood at the head of the spring that gave the pool its name. Here it was that Jamie had shed his blood in sacrifice and dashed it on that rock, asking the help of the kinsman he had slain. And here it was that Fergus had lain down, opening his veins in despair for his son, his blood blooming dark in the silent water. And I began to realize why I had come here, why the place had called me. It was a place to meet oneself and find truth. The rain passed and the clouds broke. Slowly, the light began to fade. It was nearly dark when he came. The trees were moving, restless with twilight and whispering among themselves. I didn't hear his footsteps on the sodden trail. He was just there, suddenly, at the edge of the clearing. He stood searching. I saw his head lift when he saw me, and then he strode round the pool and ducked under the overhanging branches of my shelter. He'd been out for some time, I saw. His coat was wet, and the cloth of his shirt plastered to his chest with rain and sweat.
He'd brought a cloak with him, bundled under his arm, and he unfolded this and wrapped it round my shoulders. I let him. He sat quite close to me then, arms wrapped about his knees, and stared into the darkening pool of the spring. The light had reached that point of beauty just before all colour fades, and the hairs of his eyebrows arched auburn and perfect over the solid ridges of his brows, each hair distinct, like the shorter, darker hairs of his sprouting beard. He breathed long and deep, as though he'd been walking for some time, and rubbed away a drop of moisture that dripped from the end of his nose. Once or twice he took a shorter breath, as though about to say something, but didn't. The birds had come out briefly after the rain. Now they were going to their rest, cheeping softly in the trees. "I do hope you were planning to say something," I said finally, politely, "because if you don't, I'll probably start screaming, and I might not be able to stop." He made a sound somewhere between amusement and dismay, and sank his face into the palms of his hands. He stayed that way for a moment, then rubbed his hands hard over his face and sat up, sighing. "I've been thinking all the time I was searching for you, Sassenach, what in God's name I should say when I found you. I thought of one thing and another, and there seemed nothing whatever I could say." He sounded helpless. "How is that?" I asked, a distinct edge in my voice. "I could think of a few things to say, I dare say." He sighed and made a brief gesture of frustration. "What? To say I was sorry? That's not right. I am sorry. But to say so, it sounds as though I've done something to be sorry for. And that I have not. But I thought to start off so would make you maybe think." He glanced at me. I was keeping a tight grip on both my face and my emotions, but he knew me very well. The instant he'd said, "I'm sorry," my stomach had plunged toward my feet. He looked away. "There's naught I can say," he said quietly, "that doesn't sound as though I try to defend or excuse myself. And I will not do that." I made a small sound as though someone had punched me in the stomach, and he glanced sharply at me. "I won't do it," he said fiercely. "There is no way to deny such a charge that doesn't carry the stink of doubt about it. And nothing I can say to you that doesn't sound like some grovelling apology for... Well, I will not apologize for something I have not done. And if I did, you'd only doubt me more." I was beginning to breathe a little easier. "You don't seem to have a lot of faith in my faith in you." He gave me a wary look.
"If I hadn't got quite a lot of it, Sassenach, I wouldn't be here."
He watched me for a moment, then reached out and touched my hand. My fingers turned at once and curved to meet his, and our hands clasped tight. His fingers were big and cold, and he held mine so tightly that I thought my bones would break. He took a deep breath, almost a sob, and his shoulders, tight in his sodden coat, relaxed all at once.
"You didn't think it true?" he asked. "You ran away."
"It was a shock," I said, and I thought dimly that if I stayed, I might just kill her.
"Aye, it was," he said very dryly. "I expect I might have run away myself, if I could."
A small twinge of guilt was added to the overload of emotions. I suppose my hasty exit couldn't have helped the situation. He didn't reproach me, though, but merely said again,
"You didn't think it true, though."
"I don't."
"You don't?"
His eyes searched mine.
"But you did?"
"No." I pulled the cloak close around me, settling it on my shoulders. "I didn't. But I didn't know why."
"And now you do."
I took a deep, deep breath of my own and let it go, then turned to face him straight on. "Jamie Fraser," I said, with great deliberation, "if you could do such a thing as that, and I don't mean lying with a woman, I mean doing it, and lying to me about it, then everything I've done and everything I've been, my whole life, has been a lie. And I'm not prepared to admit such a thing." That surprised him a little. It was nearly dark now,
but I saw his eyebrows rise.
What do you mean by that, Sassenach?
I waved a hand up the trail where the house lay invisible above us, then toward the spring where the white stone stood, a blur in the dark. I don't belong here, I said softly. Brianna, Roger, they don't belong here. Jemmy shouldn't be here. He should be watching cartoons on television, drawing pictures of cars and airplanes with crayons, not learning to shoot a gun as big as he is and cut the entrails from a deer. I lifted my face and closed my eyes, feeling the damp settle on my skin, heavy on my lashes. But we are here, all of us. And we're here because I loved you more than the life that was mine, because I believed you loved me the same way. I took a deep breath so that my voice wouldn't tremble, opened my eyes and turned to him. Will you tell me that's not true? No, he said after a moment, so softly I could barely hear him. His hand tightened harder on mine.
No, I will not tell you that. Not ever, Claire.
Well then, I said, and felt the anxiety and fury and fear of the afternoon run out of me like water. I rested my head on his shoulder and breathed the rain and sweat on his skin. He smelled acrid, pungent with the musk of fear and curdled anger. It was entirely dark by now. I could hear sounds in the distance, Mrs. Bug calling to Arch from the stable where she'd been milking the goats, and his cracked old voice hallooing back. A bat flittered past, silent and hunting. Claire, Jamie said softly.
Hmm?
I've got to tell you something.
I froze. After a moment, I carefully detached myself from him and sat upright.
Don't do that, I said. It makes me feel as though I've been punched in the stomach.
I'm sorry.
I wrapped my arms around myself, trying to swallow the sudden feeling of nausea. You said you wouldn't start off by saying you were sorry, because it felt as though there must be something to be sorry for.
I did, he said, and sighed. I felt the movement between us as the two stiff fingers of his right hand thrummed against his leg.
There isn't any good way, he said finally, of telling your wife you've lain with someone else. No matter what the circumstances. There's just not.
I felt suddenly dizzy and short of breath. I closed my eyes momentarily.
He didn't mean Mulva. He'd made that clear.
Who? I said, as evenly as possible. And when? He stirred uneasily.
Oh, well, when you were gone, to be sure.
I managed to take a short breath.
Who? I said. Just the once, he said. I mean, I hadn't the slightest intention of... Who?
He sighed and rubbed hard at the back of his neck.
Christ, the last thing I want is to upset you, Sassenach, by sounding as though it... But I didn't want to malign the poor woman by making it seem that she was... Who? I roared, seizing him by the arm. Jesus, he said, thoroughly startled. Mary McNab.
Who? I said again, blankly this time.
Mary McNab, he repeated, and sighed. Can you let go, Sassenach? I think you've drawn blood.
I had, my fingernails digging hard enough into his wrist as to pierce the skin. I flung his hand away and folded my own into fists, wrapping my arms around my body by way of stopping myself from strangling him.
Who the hell is Mary McNab? I said through my teeth.
My face was hot, but cold sweat prickled along my jaw and rolled down my ribs.
You ken her, Sassenach. She was wife to Rab, him that died when his house was burned. They had the one bairn, Rabbi. He was stable lad at Lallybroch when...
Mary McNab? Her?
I could hear the astonishment in my own voice.
I did recall Mary McNab. Barely. She'd come to be a maid at Lallybroch after the death of her nasty husband. A small, wiry woman, worn with work and hardship, who seldom spoke,
but went about her business like a shadow, never more than half noticed in the rowdy chaos of life at Lallybroch.
"I scarcely noticed her," I said,
trying and failing to remember whether she had been there on my last visit.
"But I gather you did."
"No," he said, and sighed. "Not like you mean, Sassenach." "Don't call me that," I said, my voice sounding low and venomous to my own ears.
He made a Scottish noise in his throat, a frustrated resignation, rubbing his wrist.
"Aye, well, see, 'twas the night before I gave myself up to the English."
"You never told me that."
"Never told you what?"
He sounded confused.
"That you gave yourself up to the English. We thought you'd been captured." "I was," he said briefly, "but by arrangement, for the price on my head."
He flipped a hand, dismissing the matter.
"It wasn't important."
"They might have hanged you."
"And a good thing, too," said the small, furiously hurt voice inside. "No, they wouldn't."
A faint tinge of amusement showed in his voice.
"You told me so, Sass. Mm-hmm. I didn't really care, though, if they did."
I had no idea what he meant by saying I'd told him so, but I certainly didn't care at the moment.
"Forget that," I said tersely. "I want to know about Mary. Aye, I can."
He rubbed a hand slowly through his hair.
She came to me the night before I went. I was in the cave, Ken, near Lallybroch, and she brought me supper. And then she stayed.
I bit my tongue, not to interrupt. I could feel him gathering his thoughts, searching for words.
"I tried to send her away," he said at last. What she said to me."
He glanced at me. I saw the movement of his head.
"She said she'd seen me with you, Claire, and that she kent the look of a true love when she saw it, for all she'd not had one herself, and that it wasn't in her mind to make me betray that. But she would give me some small thing." "That's what she said to me," he said,
and his voice had grown husky.
"Some small thing that maybe you can use."
He stopped and made that odd shrugging motion of his, as though his shirt were tight across his shoulders. He bowed his head for a moment on his knees, hands linked round them.
"She gave me tenderness," he said finally, so softly that I barely heard him. I hope I gave her the same."
My throat and chest were too tight to speak, and tears prickled behind my eyes. I remembered, quite suddenly, what he had said to me the night I mended Tom Christie's hand, about the Sacred Heart.
"So wanting, and no one to touch him."
And he had lived in a cave for 7 years, alone. There was no more than a foot of space between us, but it seemed an unbridgeable gulf. I reached across it and laid my hand on his, the tips of my fingers on his big weathered knuckles. I took a breath, then too, trying to steady my voice, but it cracked and broke nonetheless.
"You gave her tenderness. I know you did."
He turned to me suddenly, and my face was pressed into his coat, the cloth of it damp and rough on my skin, my tears blooming in tiny warm patches that vanished at once into the chill of the fabric.
"Oh, Claire," he whispered into my hair.
I reached up and could feel wetness on his cheeks.
"She said she wished to keep you alive for me. And she meant it. She didn't mean to take anything for herself."
I cried then, holding nothing back. For empty years, yearning for the touch of a hand. Hollow years, lying beside a man I had betrayed, for whom I had no tenderness. For the terrors and doubts and griefs of the day. Cried for him and me, and for Mary McNab, who knew what loneliness was. And what love was, as well.
"I would have told you before,"
he whispered, patting my back as though I were a small child. "But it was the once." He shrugged a little, helpless.
"And I couldn't think how,"
how to say it that you'd understand.
I sobbed, gulped air, and finally sat up, wiping my face carelessly on a fold of my skirt.
I understand, I said.
My voice was thick and clogged, but fairly steady now.
I do.
And I did. Not only about Mary McNab and what she had done, but why he told me now. There was no need. I would never have known. No need, but the need for absolute honesty between us, and that I must know it was there. I had believed him about Mulver, but now I had not only certainty of mind, but peace of heart. We sat close together, the folds of my cloak and skirts flowing over his legs, his simple presence a comfort. Somewhere nearby, a very early cricket began to chirp. "The rain's passed, then," I said, hearing it. He nodded with a small sound of assent. "What shall we do?" I said at last. My voice sounded calm.
"Find out the truth, if I can." Neither of us mentioned the possibility that he might not.
I shifted, gathering the folds of my cloak. "Will we go home, then?" It was too dark to see now, but I felt him nod as he got to his feet, putting down a hand to help me.
"Aye, we will."
The house was empty when we returned, though Mrs. Bug had left a covered dish of shepherd's pie on the table, the floor swept, and the fire neatly smoored. I took off my wet cloak and hung it on the peg, but then stood, unsure quite what to do next, as though I stood in a stranger's house, in a country where I didn't know the custom. Jamie seemed to feel the same way, though after a moment he stirred, fetched down the candlestick from the shelf over the hearth, and lit it with a spill from the fire. The wavering glow seemed only to emphasize the odd, echoing quality of the room, and he stood holding it for a minute, at a loss, before finally setting it down with a thump in the middle of the table.
"Are you hungry, Sassenach?"
He had begun to speak by habit, but then interrupted himself, looking up to be sure the name was once more aloud. I did my best to smile at him, though I could feel the corners of my mouth tremble. "No. Are you?" He shook his head, silent, and dropped his hand from the dish. Looking round for something else to do, he took up the poker and stirred the coals, breaking up the blackened embers, and sending a swirl of sparks and soot up the chimney and out onto the hearth. It would ruin the fire, which would need to be rebuilt before bed. But I said nothing. He knew that. "It feels like a death in the family," I said at last, "as though something terrible has happened, and this is the shocked bit, before you begin to send round and tell all the neighbours." He gave a small, rueful laugh and put the poker down.
"We'll not need to. They'll all ken well enough by daybreak what's happened."
Rousing at last from my immobility, I shook out my damp skirts and came to stand beside him by the fire. The heat of it seared at once through the wet cloth. It should have been comforting, but there was an icy weight in my abdomen that wouldn't melt. I put a hand on his arm, needing the touch of him. "No one will believe it," I said. He put a hand over mine and smiled a little, his eyes closed, but shook his head.
"They'll all believe it, Claire," he said softly. "I'm sorry."
Chapter 81. Benefit of the doubt. "It isn't freaking true!"
"No, of course not."
Roger watched his wife warily. She was exhibiting the general symptoms of a large explosive device with an unstable timing mechanism, and he had the distinct feeling that it was dangerous to be in her vicinity.
"That little bitch! I want to just grab her and choke the truth out of her."
Her hand closed convulsively on the neck of the syrup bottle, and he reached to take it from her before she should break it.
"I understand the impulse," he said, "but on the whole, better not."
She glared at him, but relinquished the bottle.
"Can't you do something?" she said.
He'd been asking himself that since he'd heard the news of Malvo's accusation.
"I don't know," he said, "but I thought I'd go and talk to the Christies at least. And if I can get Malvo alone, I will."
Thinking of his last tête-à-tête with Malvo Christie, though, he had an uneasy feeling that she wouldn't be easily shaken from her story. Brianna sat down, scowling at her plate of buckwheat cakes, and began slathering them with butter. Her fury was beginning to give way to rational thought. He could see ideas darting behind her eyes.
"If you can get her to admit that it's not true," she said slowly, "that's good. If not, though, the next best thing is to find out who's been with her. If some guy will admit it in public that he could be the father, that would cast a lot of doubt on her story, at least."
"True."
Roger poured syrup sparingly over his own cakes, even in the midst of uncertainty and anxiety, enjoying the thick, dark smell of it, and the anticipation of rare sweetness.
"Though there would still be those who'd be convinced of Jamie's guilty. Here."
"I saw her kissing Obadiah Henderson in the woods," Bree said, accepting the bottle. "Late last fall."
She shuddered fastidiously.
"If it was him, no wonder she doesn't want to say."
Roger eyed her curiously. He knew Obadiah, who was large and uncouth, but not at all bad-looking and not stupid. Some women would consider him a decent match. He had 15 acres, which he farmed competently, and was a good hunter. He'd never seen Bree so much as speak to the man, though.
"Can you think of anybody else?" she asked, still frowning.
"Well, Bobby Higgins," he replied, still wary. "The Beardsley twins used to eye her now and then, but of course..."
He had a nasty feeling that this line of inquiry was going to culminate in her adjuring him to go and ask awkward questions of any putative fathers, a process that struck him as likely being both pointless and dangerous.
"Why?" she demanded, cutting viciously into her stack of pancakes. "Why would she do it? Mama's always been so kind to her."
"One of two reasons," Roger replied,
and paused for a moment, closing his eyes the better to savour the decadence of melted butter and velvet-smooth maple syrup on fresh, hot buckwheat. He swallowed, and reluctantly opened his eyes.
"Either the real father is someone she doesn't want to marry, for whatever reason, or she's decided to try to get hold of your father's money or property by getting him to settle a sum on her, or, failing that, on the child.
Or both. I mean, she doesn't want to marry whoever it is and wants Star's money. Not that he has any."
"Or both," he agreed.
They ate in silence for a few minutes, forks scraping on the wooden plates, each absorbed in thought. Jem had spent the night at the big house. In the wake of Lizzie's marriage, Roger had suggested that Amy McCullum take over Lizzie's work as housemaid, and since she and Aidan had moved in, Jem spent even more time over there, finding solace for the loss of Germaine in Aidan's companionship.
"It isn't true," she repeated stubbornly. "Dar simply wouldn't."
But he saw the faint doubt at the back of her eyes, and a slight glaze of panic at the thought.
"No, he wouldn't," he said firmly. "Brianna, you can't possibly think there's any truth to it."
"No, of course not."
But she spoke too loudly, too definitely. He laid down his fork and looked at her, levelly.
"What's the matter? Do you know something?"
"Nothing."
She chased the last bite of pancake round her plate, speared, and ate it. He made a sceptical sound, and she frowned at the sticky puddle left on her plate. She always poured too much honey or syrup. He, more sparing, always ended with a clean plate.
"I don't," she said.
She bit her lower lip, though, and put the tip of her finger into the puddle of syrup.
"It's only..."
"What?"
"Not Dar," she said slowly.
She put the tip of her finger in her mouth and sucked the syrup off.
"And I don't know for sure about Daddy. It's only..."
Looking back at things I didn't understand at the time, now I see. She stopped abruptly and closed her eyes, then opened them, fixing him directly. I was looking through his wallet one day, not snooping, just having fun, taking all the cards and things out and putting them back. There was a note tucked away between the dollar bills. It was asking him to meet somebody for lunch.
Innocent enough.
It started out with darling, and it wasn't my mother's handwriting, she said tersely.
Ah, he said,
and after a moment...
How old were you?
11. She drew small patterns on the plate with the tip of her finger. I just put the note back and kind of blotted it out of my mind. I didn't want to think about it. And I don't think I ever did, from that day to this. There were a few other things. Things I saw and didn't understand. It was mostly the way things were between them, my parents. Every now and then something would happen, and I never knew what. But I always knew something was really wrong. She trailed off, sighed deeply, and wiped her finger on her napkin.
Bree, he said gently, Jamie's an honourable man, and he loves your mother deeply.
Well, see, that's the thing, she said softly. I would have sworn Daddy was, too. And did.
It wasn't impossible. The thought kept returning to niggle Roger uncomfortably like a pebble in his shoe. Jamie Fraser was an honourable man. He was deeply uxorious, and he had been in the depths of despair and exhaustion during Claire's illness. Roger had feared for him nearly as much as for Claire. He'd gone hollow-eyed and grim-jawed through the hot, endless days of reeking death, not eating, not sleeping, held together by nothing more than will. Roger had tried to speak to him then of God and eternity, reconcile him with what seemed the inevitable, only to be repulsed with a hot-eyed fury at the mere idea that God might think to take his wife. This, followed by complete despair, as Claire lapsed into a stupor near death. It wasn't impossible that the offer of a moment's physical comfort, made in that void of desolation, had gone further than either party intended. But it was early May now, and Malva Christie was 6 months gone with child, which meant that she'd got that way in November. The crisis of Claire's illness had been in late September. He remembered vividly the smell of burnt-over fields in the room when she'd wakened from what looked like certain death, her eyes huge and lambent, startlingly beautiful in a face like an androgynous angel's.
Right, then. It frigging was impossible. No man was perfect, and any man might yield in extremis. Once. But not repeatedly. And not Jamie Fraser. Malva Christie was a liar.
Feeling more settled in mind, Roger made his way down the creekside toward the Christie's cabin.
"Can't you do something?" Brianna had asked him, anguished. "Damn little," he thought. But he had to try.
It was Friday. He could, and would, preach an ear-blistering sermon on the evils of gossip come Sunday. Knowing what he did of human nature, though, any benefit derived from that was likely to be short-lived. Beyond that, well, lodge meeting was Wednesday night. It had been going really well, and he hated to jeopardize the fragile amity of the newborn lodge by risking unpleasantness at a meeting. But if there was a chance of it helping, would it be useful to encourage both Jamie and the two Christie men to attend? It would get the matter out in the open, and no matter how bad, open public knowledge was always better than the festering weed of whispered scandal. He thought Tom Christie would observe the proprieties and be civil, notwithstanding the delicacy of the situation. But he wasn't all that sure of Alan. The son shared his father's features and his sense of self-righteousness, but lacked Tom's iron will and self-control. But now he was at the cabin, which seemed deserted. He heard the sound of an axe, though, the slow clop of kindling being split, and went round to the back. It was Malva, who turned at his greeting, her face wary. There were lavender smudges beneath her eyes, he saw, and the bloom of her skin was clouded.
Guilty conscience, he hoped, as he greeted her cordially.
If you come to try to get me to take it back, I won't, she said flatly, ignoring his greeting.
I came to ask if you wanted someone to talk to, he said.
That surprised her. She set down the axe and wiped her face with her apron. To talk to? She said slowly, eyeing him. What about? He shrugged and offered her a very slight smile.
Anything you like.
He let his accent relax, broadening toward her own Edinburgh tinge.
I doubt you've been able to talk to anyone of late, save your da and brother, and they might not be able to listen just the new.
A matching small smile flitted across her features and disappeared. No, they don't listen, she said. But it's all right. I've not much to say, Ken. I'm a whore. What else is there?
I don't think you're a whore, Roger said quietly.
Oh, you don't? She rocked back a little on her heels, surveying him mockingly. What else would you call a woman that spreads her legs for a merit man? Adulteress, of course. But whore as well, or so I'm told. He thought she meant to shock him with deliberate coarseness. She did, rather, but he kept it to himself.
Mistaken, maybe. Jesus didn't speak harshly to the woman who was a harlot. It's no my business to be doing it to someone who isn't.
And if you come to quote the Bible to me, save your breath to cool your parrot with, she said, a look of distaste pulling down the delicate corners of her mouth. I've heard a deal more of it than I care to.
That, he reflected, was probably true. Tom Christie was the sort who knew a verse, or 10, for every occasion, and if he didn't beat his daughter physically, had almost certainly been doing it verbally.
Not sure what to say next, he held out his hand.
If you'll give me the hatchet, I'll do the rest.
One eyebrow raised, she put it into his hand and stepped back. He put up a chunk of kindling and split it cleanly in two, stooped for another. She watched for a moment, then sat down slowly on a smaller stump. The mountain spring was still cool, touched with the last winter breath of the high snows, but the work warmed him. He didn't by any means forget she was there, but he kept his eyes on the wood, the bright grain of the fresh split stick, the tug of it as he pulled the axe blade free, and found his thoughts move back to his conversation with Bree.
So Frank Randall had been, perhaps, unfaithful to his wife on occasion. In all justice, Roger wasn't sure he could be blamed, knowing the circumstances of the case.
Claire had disappeared completely without trace, leaving Frank to hunt desperately, to mourn, and then, at last, to begin to put the pieces of his life back together and move on. Whereupon the missing wife pops back up, distraught, mistreated, and pregnant by another man. Whereupon Frank Randall, whether from a sense of honour, of love, or simply of, what, curiosity, had taken her back. He recalled Claire's telling them the story, and it was clear that she hadn't particularly wanted to be taken back. Must have been damned clear to Frank Randall, too. Little wonder, then, if outrage and rejection had led him occasionally... And little wonder, too, that the echoes of the hidden conflicts between her parents had reached Brianna like seismic disturbances that travel through miles of earth and stone, jolts from an upwelling of magma miles deep beneath the crust. And little wonder, he realized with a sense of revelation, that she'd been so upset by his friendship with Amy McCullum. He realized quite suddenly that Malva Christie was crying, silently, without covering her face. Tears ran down her cheeks and her shoulders quivered, but her lower lip was caught hard between her teeth. She made no sound. He cast down the axe and went to her. Put an arm gently round her shoulders and cradled her capped head, patting her.
Hey, he said softly. Don't worry, I. It's going to be all right.
She shook her head and the tears washed down her face.
Can't be, she whispered. Can't be.
Beneath his pity for her, Roger was aware of a sense of growing hope.
Whatever reluctance he might have to exploit her desperation was well overcome by a determination to get to the bottom of her trouble. Mostly for the sake of Jamie and his family, but for her own as well. He mustn't push too hard, though, mustn't rush. She had to trust him. So he patted her, rubbed her back as he did for Jem when he woke with nightmare, said small, soothing things, all meaningless, and felt her begin to yield. Yield, but in a strangely physical fashion, as though her flesh were somehow opening, blossoming slowly under his touch. Strange, and at the same time, oddly familiar. He'd felt it now and then with Bree when he'd turned to her in the dark, when she hadn't time to think but responded to him with her body alone. The physical recollection jarred him, and he drew back a little. He meant to say something to Malva, but the sound of a footfall interrupted him, and he looked up to see Alan Christie coming toward him out of the trees, fast, with a face like black thunder.
"Get away from her!"
He straightened, heart pounding, as he realized quite suddenly what this might look like.
"What do you mean, slinking round like a rat after a rind of cheese?" Alan cried. "Do you think, since she's shamed, she's meat for any horse and bastard that cares to take her?" "I came to offer counsel," Rogers said, as coolly as he could manage. "And comfort, if I might."
"Oh, aye."
Alan Christie's face was flushed, the tufts of his hair standing on end like the bristles on a hog about to charge.
"Comfort me with apples and stay me with raisins, is it?
You can stick your comfort straight up your ass, Mackenzie, and your goddamn stiff prick, too."
Alan's hands were clenched at his sides, trembling with rage.
"You're no better than your wicked good father. Or perhaps,"
he rounded suddenly on Malva, who had stopped crying, but it was sitting white-faced and frozen on her stump.
"Perhaps it was him, too. Is that it, you wee bitch? Did you take them both? Answer me."
His hand shot out to slap her, and Roger caught his wrist by reflex. Roger was so angry that he could barely speak. Christie was strong, but Roger was bigger. He would have broken the young man's wrist if he could. As it was, he dug his fingers hard into the space between the bones, and was gratified to see Christie's eyes pop and water from the pain of it.
"You'll not speak to your sister that way," he said,
not loudly, but very clearly.
"Nor to me."
He shifted his grip suddenly and bent Christie's wrist sharply backward.
"Do you hear me?"
Alan's face went white, and the breath hissed out of him. He didn't answer, but managed to nod. Roger released his hold, almost flinging the younger man's wrist away with a sudden feeling of revulsion.
"I do not wish to hear that you've abused your sister in any way," he said, as evenly as he could. "If I do, you'll regret it. Good day, Mr. Christie. Miss Christie," he added, with a brief bow to Malva.
She didn't respond, only stared at him from eyes grey as storm clouds, huge with shock. The memory of them followed him as he strode from the clearing and plunged into the darkness of the wood, wondering whether he'd made things better or much, much worse. The next meeting of the Fraser's Ridge Lodge was on Wednesday. Brianna went as usual to the big house, taking Jemmy and her workbasket, and was surprised to find Bobby Higgins seated at the table, finishing his supper.
"Miss Brianna."
He half rose at sight of her, beaming, but she waved him back to his seat and slid into the bench opposite.
"Bobby, how nice to see you again. We thought... well, we thought you wouldn't come again."
He nodded, looking rueful.
"Aye, happen I might not. At least not for a bit. But his lordship had some things come in from England, and he says to me as I shall bring 'em."
He ran a piece of bread carefully round the inside of his bowl, sopping up the last of Mrs. Bugg's chicken gravy.
"And then, well, I did wish to come on my own account, for to see Miss Christie, eh?"
"Oh."
She glanced up and caught Mrs. Bugg's eye. The older woman rolled her eyes helpless and shook her head.
Yes. Malva, is my mother upstairs, Mrs. Bugg?"
Nay, Anian. She was called to Mr. McNeil. He's bad wi' the pleurisy.
Barely pausing for breath, she whipped off her apron and hung it on its hook, reaching for her cloak with the other hand.
I'll be along then, Lianan. Arch will be wanting his supper. If there's aught wanting, Amy's about.
And with the briefest of farewells, she vanished, leaving Bobby staring after her in puzzlement at this uncharacteristic behaviour.
"Is something amiss?" he asked, turning back to Brianna with a small frown.
Well, with a few uncharitable thoughts toward Mrs. Bug, Brianna girded up her loins and told him, grimacing inwardly at the sight of his sweet young face as it turned white and rigid in the firelight. She couldn't bring herself to mention Malva's accusation, only told him that the girl was with child. He'd hear about Jamie soon enough, but please God, not from her.
"I see, miss. Aye, I see."
He sat for a moment, staring at the bit of bread in his hands. Then he dropped it into his bowl, rose suddenly, and rushed outside. She heard him retching into the blackberry bushes outside the back door. He didn't come back. It was a long evening. Her mother was plainly spending the night with Mr. McNeil and his pleurisy. Amy McCullum came down for a little while, and they made awkward conversation over their sewing, but then the maid escaped upstairs. Aidan and Jemmy, allowed to stay up late and play, wore themselves out and fell asleep on the settle. She fidgeted, abandoned her sewing, and paced up and down, waiting for Lodge to finish. She wanted her own bed, her own house. Her parents' kitchen, normally so welcoming, seemed strange and uncomfortable, and she a stranger in it. At long, long last, she heard footsteps and the creak of the door, and Roger came in, looking bothered.
"There you are," she said with relief. "How was Lodge? Did the Christies come?"
He shook his head.
"No. It went all right, I suppose. A bit of awkwardness, of course. But your father carried it off as well as anyone might in the circumstances."
She grimaced, imagining it.
"Where is he?" "He said he thought he'd go and walk by himself for a bit. Maybe do a little night fishing."
Roger put his arms round her and hugged her close, sighing.
"Did you hear the ruckus?"
"No. What happened?"
"Well, we just had a wee blether on the universal nature of brotherly love, when a Krishmaclaver broke out, over by your kiln. Well, so everyone streamed out to see what was to do. And here's your cousin Ian, and we Bobby Higgins rolling in the dirt and trying to kill each other."
Oh, dear. She felt a spasm of guilt. Probably someone had told Bobby everything, and he had gone in search of Jamie, meeting Ian instead, and thrown Malva's accusations of Jamie at him. If she told him herself...
"What happened?" "Well, Ian's bloody dog took a hand, for the one thing, or a paw. Your father barely stopped him tearing out Bobby's throat, but it did stop the fight. We dragged them apart then, and Ian tore free and loped off into the woods, with the dog beside him. Bobby's... well, I cleaned him up a bit, then gave him Jemmy's trundle for the night," he said apologetically. "He said he couldn't stay up here."
He looked round at the shadowed kitchen. She'd already smoothed the fire and carried the little boys up to bed. The room was empty, lit only by a faint half-glow.
"I'm sorry. Will you sleep here, then?"
She shook her head emphatically. "Bobby or no Bobby, I want to go home."
"Aye, all right. You go on, then. I'll fetch Amy down to bar the door."
"No, that's okay," she said quickly. "I'll get her." And before he could protest, she was down the hall and up the stair, the empty house strange and silent below. Chapter 82. Not the End of the World. There is a great deal of satisfaction in wresting weeds out of the earth. Back-breaking and endless as the chore may be, there is a tiny but unassailable sense of triumph in it, feeling the soil give suddenly, yielding the stubborn root, and the foe lying defeated in your hand. It had rained recently, and the earth was soft. I ripped and tore with ferocious concentration. Dandelions, fireweed, rhododendron sprouts, bunch grass, muley, smartweed, and the creeping mallow, known locally as cheese. Paused for an instant, narrow-eyed, at a bull thistle, and prized it from the ground with a vicious stab of my pruning knife. The grapevines that ran up the palisades had just begun their spring rush, and sprouts and ruffles of a delicate green, tinged with rust, cascaded from the woody stems, eager tendrils curling like my own new-grown hair. God damn her! She'd taken my hair on purpose to disfigure me. The shade they cast provided refuge for immense bushy growths of the pernicious thing I called jewelweed, not knowing its real name, for the tiny white flowers that winked like diamond clusters in the feathery green fronds. It was likely a fennel of some sort, but formed neither a useful bulb nor edible seeds. Pretty, but useless, and thus the sort of thing that spreads like wildfire. There was a small swishing sound, and a ball of rags came to rest by my foot. This was followed immediately by the rush of a much larger body, and Rollo swept past me, snatching the ball adroitly and galloping away, the wind of his passage stirring my skirts. Startled, I looked up to see him bounding toward Ian, who'd come soft-footed into the garden. He made a small gesture of apology, but I sat back on my heels and smiled at him, making an effort to quell the vicious sentiments surging to and fro in my bosom. Evidently, the quelling wasn't all that successful, for I saw him frown a little and hesitate, looking at my face. "Did you want something, Ian?" I said shortly, dropping the facade of welcome. "If that hound of yours knocks over one of my hives, I'll make a rug of him." "Rollo," Ian snapped his fingers at the dog, who leapt gracefully over the row of bee gums and basket hives that sat at the far end of the garden, trotted up to his master, dropped the ball at his feet, and stood genially panting, yellow wolf eyes fixed with apparent interest on me. Ian scooped up the ball and, turning, flung it out through the open gate, Rollo after it like the tail of a comet. "I did want to ask you something, Auntie," he said, turning back to me. "It would wait, though." "No, that's all right. Now's as good a time as any." Getting awkwardly to my feet, I waved him to the little bench Jamie had made for me in a shady nook beneath a flowering dogwood that overhung the corner of the garden. "So?" I settled myself beside him, brushing crumbs of dirt from the bottom of my skirt. "Mm-hmm. Well..." He stared at his hands, linked over his knee, big-knuckled and bony. "You haven't been exposed to syphilis again, have you?" I asked, with a vivid memory of my last interview with an awkward young man in this garden. "Because if you have, Ian, I swear I will use Dr. Fentiman's syringe on you, and I won't be gentle with it. You..." "No, no," he said hastily. "No, of course not, Auntie. It's about Malva Christie." He tensed as he said it, in case I should lunge for the pruning knife. But I merely drew a deep breath and let it out again, slowly. "What about her?" I said, my voice deliberately even. "Well, no really her exactly. More what she said about Uncle Jamie." He stopped, swallowing, and I drew another slow breath. Disturbed as I was by the situation myself, I'd scarcely thought about its impact on anyone else. But Ian had idolized Jamie from the time he was a tiny boy. I could well imagine that the widespread suggestions that Jamie might have feet of clay were deeply upsetting to him. "Ian, you mustn't worry yourself." I put a consoling hand, dirt-stained as it was, on his arm. "It will work itself out somehow. Such things always do." They did, generally with a maximum of uproar and catastrophe. And if Malva's child should, by some horrid cosmic joke, be born with red hair. I closed my eyes for a moment, feeling a wave of dizziness. I suppose they will," Ian said, sounding uncertain in the extreme. "It's only what they're saying about Uncle Jamie, even his own Ardsmuir men, folk that should know better, that he must have... Well, I'll no repeat any of it, Auntie.
I cannot bear to hear it.
His long, homely face was twisted with unhappiness, and it suddenly occurred to me that he might be having his own doubts about the matter. Ian, I said, with as much firmness as I could muster, Mulver's child couldn't possibly be Jamie's. You do believe that, don't you? He nodded very slowly, but wouldn't meet my eyes.
I do, he said softly,
and then swallowed hard.
But, Auntie,
it could be mine.
A bee had lighted on my arm. I stared at it, seeing the veins in its glassy wings, the dust of yellow pollen that clung to the minuscule hairs of its legs and abdomen, the gentle pulsing of its body as it breathed.
Oh, Ian, I said, as softly as he'd spoken himself.
Oh, Ian.